This is Big Al Smith, recorded at his home in Masham in North Yorkshire on the 3rd of September 2009 by Chris Eldon Lee. Big Al Smith, Part 1.
My name is Alan Smith. What you're about to hear is a brief story of my life. I was born in Leeds, 11th of August 1935. My parents came from an humble background. We lived in a district of Woodhouse. There, we lived in a rented house, which was back to back, two bedroom, no electricity, gas lighting, no cooker, except on the fire. Shared outside toilets, cobbled streets with gas lamps, because when it rained, it gave wonderful patterns, a lovely place for a child to live, a wonderful, peaceful environment to grow up. My father was a self-educated man. He taught himself German. He had great ambitions, but unfortunately, there was no chance for further education. He had to start work at the age of 14. My mother was the same. Had to be a breadwinner at the age of 14 and worked in Leeds. Was the main business for ladies, was actually in fact tailoring. But her main hobbies was music. She played several instruments. She actually in fact became quite good, and she to fund her education in music, she worked in places like the cinema, which had no voice, and she played the backup music. She also sold sheet music, and this brought revenue so she could get further training and buy further instruments. My father, he became very good at German and very fluent, could read and write. He was asked to join a group of men to go to Germany for 3 months to promote beer, which he did, and he was the only speaking German. He went off to Germany, and it was very successful. When he came back, he astounded my mother. He said, "Whatever the government's saying, in my opinion, we'll be at war within 12 months. I'm going to join the army so I can pick the regiment and get training to improve myself of survival. Remember that my grandparents never came back from the Great War, the war to end wars in that area." 12 months later, we were at war. I was still young, but to me, war was exciting. I didn't really understand the reality of death. I had seen death, because in those days, people were laid out in the front room, but not the horrors of war. Well, like all families, the dads went off to war. My mother went into munitions. And eventually, the systems, evacuee systems, identified I was a big, strong lad, although very young. We have a place for him, because I was looking after my mother, lighting the fires, getting the tea, looking after the ration books. Although very young, I was independent. My mother brought me up right. Eventually, they said, "You must be evacuee and go away from Leeds, because it could get bombed in that area." Oh, I saw this as a great adventure. I was evacuated on a farm, and my job was to look after cows, help to milk in that sort of area. Oh, it was absolutely wonderful. There was no war. There was plenty of food, milk, water, all the things which you could do. No sweets, no hot drink like coffee or anything like that. But I wasn't used to that. I used to just drink water. But wonderfully sighted. One day, I was actually in fact sort of laying in the meadow, looking at a plant. It was an harebell. And I was looking at it, and I thought, well, how does that thing grow? and a farm operative, which they called a labourer. He fought in the First World War, was too old to do the Second World War, came over and said, "Alan, have you got a problem?" I said, "No." I said, "I didn't understand how this beautiful flower can grow in such a place, in that area. So delicate, so beautiful colours, how does it?" He actually, in fact, explained to me, and this was beginning of my further education, and it was wonderful. We built a comradeship. My father was long away. I didn't know he'd come back, but I loved my parents very dearly, but he became another father, another form of education, far better than any of the school teachers I had at school. He was living in that area. So I have no regrets for my vacuee time. War was finished. Sadly, I was brought home. Oh, came a bit of a shock to come back, because rationing still went on in that sort of area. We went back to school, and my dad's younger brother, who was in the army, and he was captured by the Japanese. He was repatriated. My dad's younger brother, in his civilian life, he actually was an artist, a commercial artist. He used to make sort of advertisements for stills which were put on the cinema slides in that area. He was really talented. He sent me letters in the beginning of the war. Was, "I can't tell you where you are," but it was just a few squiggles. But I knew he was in India because of the Taj Mahal. There was a snake in that sort of area. In those days, they photographed the letters, edited them, took out what they wanted. But somehow or other this went through and it sprung out and told me where he was. My father didn't want me to go see his younger brother after the war. He resisted this. And I said, "No, I need to go and see him." But I got a heck of a shock. He was a skeleton. He never really survived that. And I thought, I could not understand this, why the Japanese could be so cruel. And that hate for Japanese stayed for a long time and took a long time to heal. However, time moves on. Went back to school and all the young teachers came back. What a life they'd had. They were either in the RAF, the Merchant Navy, or the army in that area, all stories to tell. But then I was good at athletics, sport in that area. So now it was available because the young teachers was back. But unfortunately, I'd grown big and strong and I could no longer play against equivalent age. So I was barred in that area, which was really sad. There's another lad called Jeff Titterton. He was 6 foot in that area. He was bad as well. So how do we do? Do we sort of do things against each other in that sort of area? But very fortunately, I've been spotted by Leeds Rugby Club, who were a very wealthy club based at Headingley, and they took me under the wing to give my further sort of training in that sort of area, to get me a standard to become a professional player. This went very successful. Oh, I was eager. I loved the sport. I knew it was that area. And eventually, I signed what they call A-forms, which I lost my amateur status. But they opened an account for me. First time I'd been paid something. Like, it wasn't very much, but it went into account. Well, the good lives at school come to an end. I left school. I wasn't quite 15th because, you know, my birthday fell in August. And I thought, I knew what I wanted to do. My main love wanted to go into forestry, but I didn't have the qualifications. So I thought, well, the next best thing is apprenticeship. It's sound. It's good. And my father said William Nicholson's was a great place in Leeds to have an apprenticeship. They would have high quality standards working in hardwoods in that area. They built the Bank of England in that area. But Julia went along to my first interview and had an interview at a chap called Sir William Nicholson, the man who built the banks. Oh, dear me, I was trembling in my toes. Never met a sir or anything like that. Lo and behold, hey, I like you, lad. I'll give you a chance in that sort of area. But you can't start work until you're 15. So most people had a day off on their birthday. But on the 11th of August, I started work. Well, but unfortunately, it wasn't in a joiner's shop. It was at a timekeeping office because you had to begin at the bottom of the level. And I was looking after the time clock, the timekeeping in there and keeping the logbook of what people heard. This was a learning curve because they wanted to find out whether you could write, fill a timesheet in and things like this sort of area. Well, so I censored that. I did a year at that. Successful. They're really quite happy with me. So I was signed on, deeds apprenticeship. I had to honour the deeds apprenticeships, which was quite severe. You know, you couldn't stay out late at night and you couldn't do jobs for other people in that sort of way. It's an old-fashioned term in the area. This was absolutely fabulous. It was great. I was very honoured because today they would be called, if you like, they were just joiners. But there in my mind, you had woodcarvers. There were more. There were artists in that sort of area. And the standards, Sir William's standards were very high. He actually, in fact, inspected the work before it gone out. And he, not anybody else, he wouldn't come along on a Friday and he would go to your journeyman, the person who was teaching you his trade, as he earned his money this week. And he'd get a little report and said, right, we will pay you. And he would open up his big wallet and he would pay you the grand sum of 10 shillings. But it was wonderful. So I finished my apprenticeship and I became highly qualified. Not only work-wise, experience-wise, but academic-wise, paper-wise. Which opened a whole new horizon. But first of all, before I could go into local government, I needed to find out how good I was a joiner outside world in that area, which I did. I also did various other things as well as apprenticeships. I did outdoor pursuits where I met various people who were experts in their field, mountaineers in that area, being expeditions to the Himalayas in that area, which were a source of knowledge in that area, which led in turn to me going to, if you like, solo climbing in Scotland, in the Alps. So why did I go solo climbing? Because I needed to find out how good I was. Would I break down under hard conditions, lose my nerves in that sort of area? I have to learn it. There's no school for that. That's how you find out. Well, how did I get to the Antarctic in that sort of area? Well, first of all, William Nicholson's were asked to support a group of men who were going off to the Arctic. And they actually, in fact, had a hut. And this was provided free, a sponsorship. And they wanted a guy to go and pick it up. So that's how I got to the Arctic, the East Greenland coast in that sort of area. Further on in life, in my mountaineering career events, I met tremendous people who were very successful. I had quite a few main misses. And these near misses made me rethink. I'd lost a lot of good friends. I'd lost them in that area. And I thought, So I took former other pursuits. I went into motor rally in that area. And I met a girl, because girls weren't on my sort of agenda and this sort of way, but I met Kathleen Price, and I liked what I saw. She herself was adventurous in that area. My mother, my father had died by now. My mother's very pleased. I thought, alas, she's going to settle down in that area. So what I chose to do is thought, well, I've got to have a bit of a stable life and look for a pension. So I applied as a building inspector. And this was in the 1960s. And there was a transition of all the building laws. Now, I got qualifications in building law within this sort of area, and I understand the new forms of regulations where the local government did it, understand the new. Because at that, the code of practice, well, local code of practice, they varied all throughout the nations. Well, I became a building inspector. Well, it was very difficult. Building inspector was great in that area. I quite enjoyed it, but I found some of the senior managements had very narrow views. They would look a bit timid to take on the big boys who wasn't quite fulfilling their duties and building to the appropriate standards, which as a building inspector you have to force. Well, we continued on doing adventures like in Scotland, working on crofts, lobster fishings in that area. But I still had this one dream, right? Mount Everest had been climbed. The crossing of the Antarctic had been done by Sir Vivian. But I still had this thing about I need to go to the Antarctic. But I'd applied early in the late 50s and been rejected. I never really found out the two reasons, but I think it was like the old boys' schools, which I agree with. You've got to know somebody who's been to the Antarctic before you're given a chance. I was married, and had been married. I got married in 1961, Kathleen knew I still got that dream to fulfil. She said, "Why don't you apply to go to the Antarctic again?" So I did. To my amazement, I got an invitation to go down to the interview. Well, this interview, you know, I studied, always been interested in history, and I knew about, you know, the early expeditions, the expeditions of Cook and thereafter, and understand the climatic conditions, and also understand about permafrost, understand about the glacial things within that area. I was really armed with things, and I left Leeds on a train early morning, and at that time the interview place was at Gillingham Street in that sort of area, and I duly around at Gillingham Street. I had your time to reflect on what you're going to do, like, you know. The interview panel were there, leading people were made me very welcome, and they, to my amazement, didn't really ask me any questions about this. They were really more concerned about my age, because I was much older in that sort of area. And one of the problems is, like, but some of my references were quite, if you like, mature and tremendous achievements in that area. And I think one of the major concerns was, in the past, there are some people who had used a trip to the Antarctic to conquer mountains for their own gain. But I wasn't like that. I was going to go there to support science in that sort of area. Well, the interview didn't last very long, only 30 minutes, and I thought, I've blown it. I've actually blown it in that area. I was told to go and claim my spark in that area. Then Sir Vivian came along, and I knew Sir Vivian once, read his books, claimed that here. Oh, right, I'd like you to come and have a come down and have lunch with me. So I went to a local pub. I forget the name, but it was only a short distance away. And I think that was a proper interview. And then I got home 10 days later, over there. And I went to the conference then. I was invited to go to this conference. But what you've got to bear in mind, that the conference, it wasn't really formalised in any proper structure as such, because you were still FIDS at that time. I like to believe it was still an expedition. It wasn't a job. In my interview, I didn't even know but I was going to get paid. I'd have gone for nothing. It wasn't until the interview till the sort of conference, that I realised I'd be paid. Okay, it wasn't a grand sum. I think the figure was about £700. I think earlier it was about £500 in this sort of area. But it wouldn't matter. I wanted to fill that dream. Well, what was the purpose of the conference? The purpose of the conference was to bring all the people who were going to travel down to the Antarctic within a year together for the very first time. Because normally I'd be able to choose your friends, but here they were being chosen for you to bring you together. That was really exciting. We stayed in the college. First time I stayed in university college, I was overwhelmed with the facilities. And I go, good God, this is first class in that area. Well, the conference was very well structured in such. Each of the disciplines of scientists give their aims, ambitions, and explain the science in that area. Well, there were some of them I really understand, particularly the biological, marine biological, and geology in that area. But upper atmosphere, I haven't been really strong. I didn't really understand it. I understand what the ionosphere was like in that area. But I wasn't afraid to ask the question to find out the situation. Okay. Also, what was very important, it was to meet the senior staff. Because at that time, everybody was spread about in the various universities. The headquarters was in Gillingham Street, which was something like about 12 people only. Yeah. And there, Sir Vivian. Well, Sir Vivian, as far as I'm concerned, he was actually fat. Great, a great chap. Very understanding within that area. I could see nothing wrong. He's a chap I'd like to sort of really admire. And Sir Vivian had a deputy director, Ray Eady. Now, Ray Eady was another character, a geologist. Ray Eady actually, in fact, went down to the Antarctic before Sir Vivian. He sledged down the what was called Parmaland, the Antarctic Peninsula, and put the geology of the Antarctic Peninsula together in this sort of area. There were other people which I met, but what really stuck on my mind, will always stay there, but the last lecture was by Sir Raymond Priestley. Sir Raymond Priestley had been, if you like, he was on Scott's expedition, last expedition. He spent a winter in a cave in the deer and survived. He gave a lecture which I found very fascinating. Is the past, the present and the future. Absolutely superb. Later on in life, when I moved up the ladder in Bassett, you might say, I had the opportunity to speak to him in great depth. In fact, if I could just skip a few years here, I think it's very important. I said, sir, may I say to you, boy, you're a man of steel who sailed in wooden ships, and I'm a man of wood who sailed in ships. And he said, no, Alan, with his bright eyes. He said, no, he said, I'm a man of my time, and you're a man of your time. Which is quite true in that area, because time moves on. Well, the conference was over, which was really good, really enjoyed. It wasn't like a modern conference today, but no, I didn't mean it. Because in those days, the general assistants were all keen mountaineers. They'd done their apprenticeship. The main aim of a general assistant was to look after the, if you like, the scientists who probably hadn't had adventurous life in that sort of area. But so be it. Went home. I just had enough time to hand in my notice, which came a bit of a shock to my employers. But when I explained where I was going, they were very well supported, because I needed a bit more longer time than I should have done. But they did support me, and they said, well, your job's there when you come back, Alan, and tell us the tales. And this sort of way. Well, the sailing date had arrived. I don't like saying farewells at the quay in that area, because I think it's terrible to drift away from your loved ones in that area. I like them to be gone. However, my wife, She wanted to go see the vessel I was going to make this wonderful trip on, which I understood. So we went with a friend the day before. And we went to the docks and had a look at this little red ship called Jumbisco. And the tide was out. It was down in the mud at the bottom. I said, "Away, just a mast, the crow's nest sticking up like it is." And we went around and we said, "There's a little ship on, it's only like a little yacht, isn't it?" Like, you know, "Oh, yeah," but I said, "It's got a history, hasn't it?" Like, you know. I said, "I mean, good company." I said, "Do you know?" I said, "The Duke of Edinburgh sailed on that in 1957. I said, "If it's fit for him and safe for him, it's safe for me." Like, you know, so don't worry about that. So, well, I said that night, we went out to dinner, and then the following morning, my wife went home with her chauffeur to drive back, because it's the right thing to do. And I joined the ship in that area and got stuff stored away. And, well, the time was for the boom, guests to leave and that sort of air. And it's as I imagine, the ship slowly drifted away and the tears and the waving in that area. And off we went down the Solent. The great adventure beginning in that sort of way. Why, what an adventure. We immediately were given a lecture, basically, which is quite right, on lifeboat procedures and the safety of the ships and this sort of situation. And also introduced to the King Fid. Now, the King Fid is a name which actually fact was, he was the liaison officer between the rest of the Fids and the captain, his officers in that area. And so that was good, because if you had any complaints or the captain had any complaints, they went through backwards and forwards. And he'd been down to the Antarctic probably more than once in that area, so he knew the roles in that area. But it was a very relaxed atmosphere. There were no disciplines in that area, but it was a good procedure. And normal base life was set up as well by... Because you did scrub outs, you did served on gash in the area. You didn't do cooking because of professional cooks in the area. And the ship I found quite difficult. I'd spent time at sea, but it stunk of diesel fuel. So I was seasick for a week. But I didn't stay in bed. I got on with it. But if you've been seasick, it's uncomfortable a bit, like, you know. However, we got past the BFG Abisky. Because their top speed really was 12 knots, but every steaming was 8 knots. So it's very relaxed sort of speed, as you might say. We got further down the tropics and things got warm. And we did courses, first aid, you name it, everything in this sort of area. And we worked on the ship, painting, holy scraping that area. Well, it went very quickly and we arrived at Montevideo. Well, Montevideo was a place, never been to South America before, but it was like a time capsule, old cars in the area, a beautiful place, very relaxed, very British in so many ways, you know. I mean, they had a system like Britain had with a health service, very poor. You had a vary between poor and very, very rich in that area, but a wonderful stay. I met quite a few people, became permanent friends. Well, time to leave there. And it was incredible. When we came out of the River Plate, it only seemed to be a matter of hours, but the water was still brown for the effect of the River Plate, which is a great river. And but then, after about 24 hours or so, we saw penguins. For the very first time, these penguins skipping along in the water. We thought, this is great. I think it was about 3.5 days later, we arrived at the Falkland Islands. And the Falkland Islands, well, we sailed through what they call the Narrows into Port Stanley, which is off in the area. It was a beautiful day. The sun was shining. The water was crystal clear. You could see the Kemp floating in the water. You could look across at Stanley's laid out in a grid. And there, the houses were... White houses with red roofs in the air, laid out in a grid fashion, and the concrete road going up the centre, and the smell which I'm familiar, was peat in the air. A wonderful sight. Reminds me of home, the west coast of Scotland. Duly landed, unloaded the cargo area, mail and provisions in the area. And we got kitted out. There was the ticking measurements at the conference in that area. But unfortunately, I was last in the line, as you might say, and I couldn't get kitted out properly but I'd preempted this. My experience is never be separated from your knife and fork. To survive, take what you need yourself. A lesson to be learnt many years ago. Anyway, windproofs fit, boots fit, and gloves fit, and hat fit. That was the lot in that area. That was no problem. Well, I found the people very, very friendly, and very welcoming. Because you've got to remember, at that time, there was an office there as well. All the communications, to run the communications. So Bass really was a big employer of the colonists. And I went along and I went to one of the pubs and there and I met George and Velma. They actually, in fact, were very welcoming because there were no restaurants at all. But if you, for instance, because of the weather, couldn't get back to the ship, they provided you a floor to sleep on. They would provide you some food, if necessary, in that area. Now, George, over the years, became a great friend in that area. He was in the commandos during the war, went to the Falkland Islands, but he thought he was going to the Hawaii-type islands in the Southern Oceans, but finished up in the Falklands. But he was a shepherd, but he loved the life in that area, actually, because he was interested. It was interesting to listen to him about bringing the wool in with six in hand in the area. So this is a class characters within that area. Now, in the Falklands at that time, there were two sort of systems. There were Chays and there were expats, as you might say, which had all the key jobs in that area. So I had previous experience of that sort of situation, like which I just simply have to accept. But anyway, we were invited along to have an interview with the governor. Because the governor, actually, in fact, at that time, said whether you'd go further down to the Antarctic. Well, the governor, basically, we had an interview, and it was very interesting, really. He asked me some questions, and I knew about living, and I knew about what was on the Falklands in that area. I knew the coastline, and I had never been, but I'd read the information, and we became very friendly in that sort of area. That interview was over. Then we had the dreaded party, where you stand up with cocktail sticks in this sort of area. And then it was a time to leave Stanley. And the next phase of the adventure started. And we were bound for Sydney Island. At Sydney Island, there, we were about 48 hours away, and the ship entered pack ice. Now, I'd experienced pack ice before, but my cabin mate hadn't seen it. And the ship, it was night, although light, came to a rest. It wasn't beset, it just but the captain needed to go to bed in that area to evaluate time in that area. Anyway, next morning we went forward and we could see the base in the distance. But there was fast ice there, meaning fast ice, but the ship couldn't, at that time, didn't have the strength to break it. It did its best. So we did part relief as such, which was manholing the stores to the base in that area. Oh, the base was a wonderful society. Coronation Island with glaciers and mountains there, such a wonderful setting. And Sydney's packed with life in that area. So a decision was made, but really what we ought to do is to, we've got the main supplies off, the main meal and some goody food in that area, and some people were getting off to do the work and left there. So we left. Now, I've been scheduled to support a geologist and make some landings in some remote places, which I don't want to go enough because basically I've forgotten all the places we landed in that area. But what came to my mind was, well, when he said, "Oh, I'm on fixed orders," he said, like sealed orders. He said, "I can't open them." He said, "I didn't even know where I was going to go." Like, and he said, "And you know where your end destination is, Alan." I said, "Trent, why did they do that?" He said, "The reason why they do that," he said, "is because we can read all the stuff and we can get fixed ideas in that area," which I thought was a good idea, really. And this was Ray Eady, because he didn't want to read his geology, because he made some mistakes, and he wants original science in that area. So it was great. And I really enjoyed that, supporting the scientists. My main thing, really, was dead easy. I was the umpa, really, make sure, because we had a small boat where we made these landings, take some samples. We had a mothership to be picked up. Oh, it was great fun. And then that bit was over, and so then we sailed down to Argentine Island, which was Faraday. And to get there, you go through the Lemaire Channel. And it was incredible, because we'd left sort of fast ice and some brash pack in that area, and the Lemaire Channel was completely clear. And the Lemaire Channel, we had beautiful weather. And it's very difficult. There's no film, no speech can fill this, but if you just think of mountains, a narrow field, and mountains reaching up, covered in snow, glistening in the light, all sorts of different colours, absolutely stunning. Absolutely. It was beyond words. We're calling at Palmer Station, which is an American station in the area. Well, the Americans have got everything, haven't they? Got walking freezes, you name it. Like, you know, I thought, oh, good God, I hope my base is not like this, you know. However, we dropped their mail off, like, and went to have a look at the old Bannon base, which was at the side of it, like, in that area. And then we went further on, and we went to Argentine Island there. This is what a wonderful setting. Argentine Island is a small island, but you get wonderful views looking back up to the main channel. And, you know, it's very restricted, the island. But it was a static base for doing upper atmosphere work, not for adventurous types who needed to get to Crosswood in that area, but it fulfilled it. But a lovely timbered building. And it had the old linoleum, red floors, and they shone. Because people wore tint slippers and polished the floors. And each of the places were heated with coal fires in the area, cooked by coal fires. Well, everybody had all this new gear, and the first one was the coal run, as you might say. So we did the roof, and the people were covered in coal dust, as you might say. But it was great, a great place within that area. However, time to come. We couldn't go any further south, because the new... At that time, the Margaret Bay area was still in ice in that area. The radio office used to have what's called a goon show. And the goon show was where the radio, ships of radio, used to talk to all the radio operators to get conditions in this sort of situation. And he knew there was fast ice because there were no satellites and that sort of thing. It was just visual things. And the captain had very flexible sailing orders. All the sailing orders said was relieve the stations. You know, that was it. That was it, under his discretion. So, and I was bound for Halley Bay. And so, therefore, the idea was to come back to Sydney, where we did the full relief. We came back to the Falkland Islands and I transferred to the Paula Dan. The Paula Dan, on the board there, Paula Dan, was the rest of the wintering parties and other people who would give support in erecting the new station. We duly left in the Paula Dan. Now, the Paula Dan was so different to our ships because you didn't have to do gas duties. People washed up in that area, and the food was different. It was the type of food I liked, fish and that area, cold starch in that area. And you got a beer, you know, although it was plumbing type, lager type stuff, but it was a beer. And I thought, good God, this is five-star living. I've never lived like this. So the ship was very comfortable and we sailed for South Georgia. We landed at South Georgia, which is a spectacular island. We went to a place called Gritbican. And Gritbican is, well, it was just about an operating whaling station, just coming towards the end. That was quite an experience. And down the, what they call Kingwood Point, was the point was the administration office in that area. And they had been earlier, the Shackleton had dropped off two people to do one geologist, Mike Skidmore, and one general assistant. And he, in actual fact, part of their brief was to cull elephant seals to feed the dogs at Halley, because getting seals at Halley apparently was very difficult, not easy. And so they all on the shore, they're all killed. We've got Julie on board in that area. And the Cossack came on board and had a look round, and we had huskies on the decks. So I immediately volunteered to look after these husky pups in this sort of situation, like, you know. And they were aware, but I'd had some experience on this anyway, you know, the system. And it was quite remarkable, the system. I could pick up things up, like, you know. So off we were duty bound. We sailed off in that area. And we entered the Weddell Sea. And the Weddell Sea was notorious, like. And in those days, you could guarantee, but you'd have 800 miles, maybe 1,000 miles of ice to get through. And of course, they would navigate backwards and forwards in that area, taking the fixings. And there you would do your duties on the deck. You'd do whale watch in that area and check certain things. And eventually, yeah, we got within sight in that area of the mainland, coastland. Narin, I knew about. I'd read all the histories of the early ships going down. And I knew, like, but on Shackleton, when Shackleton was in that area, he'd done a recording of all that area. And I knew roughly the latitude where we were. But what he was seeing was there in that area. Right, so we came round the, there was a lead. We sailed down the lead between, which is risky because there's a possibility, but if the wind and current changes, the ship could be crushed across the ice shelf. But these Danish chaps were very skilled in that area. Now, the station where I was going, called Halley Bay, actual fact, it was so unlike the Antarctic Peninsula. It's actually fact built on a floating ice shelf. And this ice shelf, it rises and falls with the tide. And it's about something of about 56 miles or 87 miles. It actually fact sort of is attached to the inland ice by a zone called the Yin Zone. Why the reason why they call the Yin Zone? Because it rises with the tide and it flexes in this sort of situations. So this was featureless. It was flat within this sort of area, apart from its core, underwave until you get inside. Well, I knew that. And some of the lads didn't quite think they were looking for mountains. Didn't let on to them. But eventually, we got to what we call... there were two bays. There were Emperor Bay and there were Halley Bay. And Emperor Bay is where the breeding colonies, emperors were like. And Halley Bay is where the IGY first made their landing in that area. And we were actually, in fact, going to take over, rebuild another station to replace the old stations, which had a chattered history of a building within that area. So we duly landed. 24 hours were all worked off, and the set was to get the cargo off as quick as possible and as safely as possible without losing anything. And it's as well the original plans did this. It was interesting, I'd been talking to the captain, trying to pick his brains on ice conditions in the Antarctic, because it's nice to talk to people who understand these things. And I said, what I couldn't really understand is, I understand what they do carve off, but why has Halley Bay stayed there so long? And he put it down to a fact, but there was a great big grounded iceberg there. Now, I mean, what happened is this iceberg during our drive, I noticed this along with the ship's officers' notice, but it shifted position. Another during the course, and the iceberg come down and hit it, and the buoyancy altered it, and it went off. Well, we just got all our stuff ashore within that area, and people were safe, and then there was almighty crack in that area. And Halley Bay and Emperor Bay were no longer there. It was just a clean ice front, just leaving a very narrow entrance to a steep sort of ramp in that area. And I thought that was fascinating. But people go on about, but this is natural way. It comes to a point where it's gone beyond its length and it breaks away in that area. Oh, well, great. The other problem is, well, next year, what happens if this lot goes away next year? How do you get relieved, you know? Anyway, we're very successful. What we did is we got on the building phase and we started the buildings. And during the summer, we did very well. We got the buildings up. We got everything ship-shape in the air, the generators installed. And it was the time ship for the Pearl of Den. Now, one of my jobs was, because I said I was a GA, I was capable of being plumber in that area. So my task was to build a coal stove, which is very important because that would do the cooking and make the water in that area. Well, I never saw the ship leave. My duty was to finish that stove and light a fire for my comrades to return warm, because the weather was inclement in that sort of, which I achieved. But I thought, good God, I had a problem there. And when I closed the door, everything was done right. You know, I hadn't been on a course, but I just used my skills to put it together. The door wouldn't close. I opened it up and I thought, why won't this close? And on it was a little plaque in that sort of area. It says, if you have problems during the course of erection, ring this number in here. And I noticed there was some really big screws on it. So I took these screws out of the plank, clunk it closed. Fire lit, and I could make water because I've got the tank in and that sort of thing. So the ship duly watched. Now I went down to have a look at the base, which the base members were living in, the conditions. And there I thought, good God, we need to get this place finished quickly. In my mind eye, I wasn't in charge of a chap called Jim Shercliffe, and I was very aware, but I was just a fit, you know, and no powers. And I had a look around in the area, and the bunk rooms, there was hardly any room from the bunk rooms. They were crushed in that area, because what there is the original, if I'd explained first, which I should have started to do, there were very layers. It's like being in a coal mine. You've got a very deep IGY building, then you've got another phase of buildings, then another phase. So it's like three tiers in the area, and there were decks and ladders moving around it difficult. But the living block, when they built the living block and the office blocks in that area, and this was designed and shipped by Crown agencies, like, you know, and I'm not criticising here, but they forgot the bolts, or high percentage of the bolts to put together, and the lads that were there, the builder and his supporters, did all they could like to ensure it, like, you know, but relenting ice had crushed the roof in the area. And in the bunk rooms during the summer and the lounge, they had drip trays. An ingenious idea where they lit all the water down and people were sleeping there. But in winter, it's another thing in that area. There, it was minus 18 in the lounge. It's not so bad, minus 18 in the bedroom, because you're in a sleeping bag, you're all right. Now, minus 18 is the average temperature light, so it won't get any colder. Like in the air, although the air temperature outside, it could go down to about minus 57. And this is not wind chill factor. This is just still air factor. But it was great on the base in that sort of area. And we used to show, we used to go down there on a Saturday night, and they cook a meal in the area. And we used to show films. Oh, it was great in that area. And the film used to break because selenite doesn't like cold. There was more patches and patches on films, but it was great. And there was a chap there, very talented in that area. And they made a magazine in that area, which I still have the copy. And it's called Halley Comet in that area. And he drew little cartoons in that area and closed the flaming door, you know, because it's cold. And what it was is he was inside the oven of the firelight, and the beer was on top of the thing. Absolutely superb. Although there were two stations, there was no division in that area. And at that time, Ricky Chin was a base commander who was living on the original base, and Jim was in charge of that, but we didn't call Jim one base commander. He was team leader, as you might say. And we'd done very well. We were all prepared to work out in all sorts of conditions. We got the external finished, and then our aim was to, so the base, existing base, could come up at Midwinter's Day, use the lounge, and kitchen be finished, and we'd have an entertainment, which was great. It was superb, and it did work. Unfortunately, Crown Agents underestimated this for the very first time, but they'd ever sent quite a few professional joiners down. Normally it's only been one or two, but here there was more. And we run out of materials. In fact, we were using packing cases to make things in that area, so we couldn't do any more work within that sense. Material just wasn't there. But the base was really in first-class conditions in that area. And it was so, because it was interconnecting. It wasn't climbing ladders. It was all interconnected. You could move around. And it was a heck of a size as well. It could accommodate 40 people who were in that area. Well, it's a very important time. About there was 85 dogs there to be looked after. I helped with that, the breeding of dogs, looking after puppies in that area. The survival rates of puppies at Harley were a bit delicate, because unfortunately the breeding program was midwinter when the coldest temperatures there. But we did our best, and we built a snow tunnel for dogs to go in, but they don't like being in snow tunnels in this sort of area. Then feeding, you know, they're feeding the dogs, cutting khakis up with axes and chainsaws in this sort of area. Well, there were other things went on. There was never a dull moment, because down in the night, you did first aid courses. You had to learn Morse code in that area, CW, because, you know, there was no walkie-talkies or anything like that. It was CW. And people give various lectures of what they were doing in the area. I learned how to launch balloons, how to plot things in that area. I also learned about telerometers, measuring great distances, because that's what uses these in the field. And telerometers were relatively primitive today's standards, but they were great, because at Halley there were some of the longest measurements ever taken in the Antarctic in that area. I'll explain about what is a telerometer a bit later on. Well, Halley was an operating field station, and previous time they'd actually, in fact, got across the end zone, because the end zone was a natural barrier. It really was a natural barrier. There'd been several attempts and been failed, and it's chaos, an unsafe place. You need to be very careful indeed, and you can never take the same route, although flagged in that area. There had been a storage, what they call a bob pie hut. They'd managed to get a bob pie hut there, which is an emergency hut place in that area. But all that was done before I got a great achievement. And it is, and the planning and the geology and the mapping of the Tottons and the Therons. But our aim was to get to the Shackleton Range. Not my aim, but the field people's aim was to get to the Shackleton Range. I was destined to, although I love dogs, I don't know why, but Ricky Chin chose me, another person, to be the first to use skidoos at Halley. Skidoos had been used at Sydney, quite successful getting around there, but never pulling great weights, and had been used at Stonington, but they condemned them because they were doggy men in that area, you know, but so be it. But the skidoos we had at that point in time were nothing like the skidoos today. They were toys, were in that area. So I was a GA to a chap called Bob Thomas, and the light returned. The temperature was still around about minus 35. He was a very keen chap to get going, so we got going. And he had a motor toboggan called an Alliance, and I had the skidoo, and we set off. Now, operating these temperatures, a two-stroke engine at that sort of temperatures and a four-stroke engine is not easy in that area, but we went off, we went through there. And we had to find a way across the end zone in this sort of area. We had some problems, which I won't go into, quite difficult problems. Now, comradeship in the Antarctic is usually pretty good, but you all intents and purposes, you always have some sort of disagreements. And Bob and I, we had a disagreement. He was a scientist. Bob Thomas. Bob was a scientist. He was keen because he was a first glaciologist and he wanted to get this work, which I understand. But my job was to find, but we get there, do the work and get back safely. We were pushing beyond what I considered, because I understood whiteout conditions and that sort of area. Although, I understood all that because I've experienced it before. If I could explain whiteout conditions, if you can't see a meter in front or anything like this, I mean, you got to a point where visibility was down to 5 meters. And I said, Bob, we stop, we camp. And he said, no, we've got to go on. I said, no, we're in a dangerous zone here. We're surrounded by crosses, we stop. And gradually he agreed. We pitched a tent. And the visibility 24 hours later has improved. And by God, he was glad we stopped. There was holes everywhere. In fact, in my log, I wrote I was beginning to think that the Antarctic was full of holes. Anyway, Bob was quite happy then. We great comradeship from them. We set it out. He realised, but I wasn't looking after his benefit, but we get through and we had no problems because when the weather was good, I didn't need sleep. So I was like him, yeah. And what we did is there, we set up, we were doing sun shots, fixes, astronaut shots and all that area, bringing in the telerometers, which another team, some 56 kilometres away. And what we were trying to measure is the if you like, the movement of the Brunt ice shelf. And we need triangulations to find how it's moving, the drifting in the air, pressures and strains. I won't go on about glaciology, but it's fascinating. It's first time. And we set up these, we made contact. Now, these were used for the during the army as such. And they're all they are is like a rangefinder in the area. And you can speak to the other one, which is, we had the master and there's a slave over there. But you have to take temperature because it affects the wave frequencies, because you're measuring how long it took the wave frequencies to come back in that area. And we were pushing the limits, like all feds push the limits of man and equipment. We were doing that. And this was really successful. Now, the first time, actually, in fact, there was another chap, actually, in fact, who was a surveyor. And he, I could use a theodolite. That wasn't any problem. I could do sun shots in that area because I took my own sextant with me. Because I thought, well, I need to navigate. I'm used to my sextant. But my sextant was not like a ship's sextant. It was a sextant that was used by the RAF in this sort of area, which the lead aircraft would use. And you could set it up. You didn't need a horizon in that area. You just need to see the sun's shadow. And you kept it on for it. So it was light and not bulky within this sort of area. But I'd never done a star shot, particularly when the sun's shining, But it's so easy when you think about it. You actually, in fact, got to get an astronomical canal, calculate where it is, like, you see it, like, which is much more accurate than the sun, because doing a pass in the area. And Bob was quite pleased with that. It's an accurate positioning. Nothing like where you stick a post in and a satellite goes over. But we were getting within sort of, plus or minus, let's say 4 metres, which isn't bad, is it, like, within that area. However, that glacial program came to an end in that year, and I came back to base. Actually, found a wonderful time with the winter, and my sort of near the time of going back, we have an accident now. John Brotherhood, oh, great character, and Jim Shercliffe, And as far as I'm concerned, later on, I always put doctors down as hazard rangers because if anybody's going to get injured on a base, it's a doctor, in that sort of way. But I'm not taking the mickey. Absolutely wonderful character. And what he was doing, he'd done carried out tests on us, and he really liked me, energy expenditure and fat gain, and did night deprivation and all sorts of weird things I did with you. But he was wearing the imp, which is energy expenditure on, and they were doing manholing in that area. Now, they'd filled in the logbook where they were going. There were two routes in this sort of area. And unfortunately, the weather the weather had turned badly, and there was fire, and they never reported back. And Ricky came to, in all intents and purposes, to me and to Alan Johnson, who had just returned from the field, and he said, we need to go look. Now, I should have explained slightly earlier, but on base, there were three Alans in that sort of area. Now, Alan Edgells was the oldest, so what do you call him? Dad. I was the second oldest sort of thing, so what do you call me? My name can't be any shortened to Al. So I was Big Al in that area. And Alan Johnson, you know, Alan was called Mad Al. Now, why did he get Mad Al? Oh, very bright, intelligent person. He was something of about 29. This was his first job. Had a couple of PhDs in that sort of area. Had a crack at various things. Wanted to go into to be a priest in that sort of area, but backed out from that in that area. So this was his first job. But he was absolutely superb in that area. So he'd got to be mad to spend all that time at school and college and learning. So that's how we got the names. Anyway, Ricky came out and said, look, the weather's not good, but I'm worried about these. So we both said, no, we'll go and look in that sort of area. We tried the first route and we couldn't find any signs of them. So it's obviously the second route. When the weather's not bad, if you're looking for tracks, you look sideways. And everybody at Halley, there was no maps, you worked on compass bearings. So if you were following the same compass bearings, you got a fair idea, but you'd pick some tracks up. Well, we got off. Now, Alan, he was a great surveyor, and I actually faxed said, we haven't got a map at all. I said, you can go to the darkest Africa, you can get a shell map and drive on it like. But here at Halley, it's all compass bearings. I have a map on the wall in my study, which he did for me as a present. But I knew his... very reliable. We sledged out to the end using a sledge wheel for distances in that area, and I'd got a glimpse of tracks, but we're on the right line. But the weather, we knew we were getting close. So what I did is I made snowballs, and my windproofs were covered in seal, made them black and threw them. I got to the edge till they disappeared, and I knew I was on the edge. I was on a safety line tied to the skidoo, just in case I take one step too far. And we had to turn back. We couldn't make contact with base to tell them because we had what they call a squad call radio, which could get somebody in Hong Kong, like, but, you know, sort of 25 miles away. No. So we turned back to base and said, well, sorry, we're unsuccessful, but we did see tracks in that area. We're not sure what happened to them. Anyway, this storm, actually, in fact, it went over... and about 18 or 19 hours, as soon as the visibility we could see, we went out again. A group of us made a track stacks and come down the ravine, and we found a tent pitched. And then we thought, good God, they're alive. Because there's always a problem with the sea ice going out and all that air, they're alive. And inside, Jim Shercliffe had broken his leg, and the doctor was in a very sort of bad way. His knee had gone through his face in that area and did damage it. We weren't quite sure whether he'd broke his back or whatever like that. So we treated him that way and brought him back safely using skidoos and sledges under the safe conditions and got him to the hospital in the surgery place in that sort of area. And there we had to start using X-rays on him. Well, this X-rays should have been in the archives somewhere, you know. And we had no clue, but we had some knowledge about photography in that area. So what we did is we lined, because we knew about overdosing, because the doctor was the expert and he needed our help. So we tried it out on various people in that area we get by. And we had the brainy people and we had a couple of people. We all put us out together and we got these X-rays. Now, when Ricky had made contact with Sir Vivian, and it was at weekend, accidents always happened at weekend, and Sivian was aware in that sort of area. And it was quite clear, but he needed evacuation because we couldn't do a lot for him and we could see light, but it would be permanent damage if he didn't have some facial rebuild on his face in that area. But I might not be true factum here, but I imagine Sir Vivian just picking up his phone and ringing his counterpart in the White House, say, in the States, saying, one of our guys at Halley is actually factoring in trouble, like, you know, and we need help in that area. And the other bloke said, leave it with me, like, you know, I'll dispatch an aircraft, like, in that sort of area. Lo and behold, not only one aircraft, but two aircraft left over, you know, from New Zealand, McMurdo, over the pole and flew round. But what the remarkable thing about it is, we were able to send details because one of the guys was really good. He came up with this idea of breaking the image down into boxes in the era. Breaking the image down into boxes, we transmitted that data, and it worked in that area. I mean, it's all digital. Well, these aircraft landed in that area. We were equipped, we had fuel in that area, and the one aircraft was circling. They evacuated him, thank God, in that area. But there's lots of stories to tell there, but it's written. Anyway, that came to the end of that episode. And we actually, in fact, came to the end of this period, as you might say, because the relief was about and the time was to go out. We still work to do, and then I left on the Pearl of Dan and went back to the Falklands. Do you want to stop?